Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When today's guest, Nadina La Spina, was just a baby, she contracted polio. Growing up in Sicily in the 1950s with little access to medical care, her parents feared she would not get better. As a child, Nadina remembers her neighbors and family members telling her how pretty she was and what a shame it was that she was disabled. When she was a teenager, her family decided to immigrate to the United States so she could receive medical care. Today, polio is nearly eradicated. Since 1988, it has decreased by over 99%, and only three countries in the world still encounter it today. Through her experience with polio, Nadina La Spina has embraced her disability and has been heavily involved with the disability rights movement for decades. Nadina La Spina has been arrested countless times for civil disobedience and has worked with many groups, including Disabled in Action, American Disabled for Attendant Programs Today, and the Disability Caucus. After teaching Italian for many years, Nadina La Spina created and taught courses in disability studies at the New School in New York City where she lives. And she's out with a great new memoir called Such a Pretty Girl, a story of struggle, empowerment, and disability pride. And Nadina La Spina joins us in studio. Hi, Nadina. Thank you so much for coming in.
I'm so happy to be here.
Well, I'm so happy that you made it. Because
that I made it, right?
I understand that you have had such a hard time getting a cab with a ramp in San Francisco.
Yes, especially yesterday. Yesterday I had to shows that I was going to tape. I had to go to Berkeley, and I thought I will take a cab to Berkeley, make it easier on myself, and spend the money. And I waited and waited for an hour and a half, and I kept calling the cab company, and they kept telling me the cab was coming, and it never showed up. So it was very aggravating, very frustrating. I never expected to in San Francisco for it to be so difficult. And in New York City, we've been fighting a long time for accessible cabs. And at this point, we can get a cab easily enough.
What was it like when you asked your hotel to try to find a cab for you?
Oh, they didn't know what to do. I mean, they offered to get me a regular cab and get my wheelchair in the cab. But this chair, even though it looks like a manual chair, it is not. It's motorized and it is heavy. It has motors in the wheels, and it has a battery in the back. So it could not be put into any car. I really needed a cab with a ramp, and I was lucky enough to get one today. So here I am.
I'm so glad you did. Just overall, what is your experience like in trying to do something as simple as find transportation?
It's always difficult. In New York, the difficulty is with our very old subway system. Many of the stations there are not wheelchair accessible. And at times, the elevators break down even in those stations that are accessible. So at this point, we have quite a few lawsuits against the Metropolitan Transit Authority. And I missed a demonstration yesterday at one of the subway stations. But it is a very old system compared to BART, I guess.
Right, because sometimes the problem with BART is the elevators are either not working, or after 9/11 they stopped making sure that they worked. And then in New York City, I've noticed sometimes when I'm there that there are no elevators.
That's
only
because that station,
stairs.
That station is not one of the accessible stations.
And I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, wasn't the Americans with Disabilities Act supposed to take care of all of this and deal with this?
The Americans with Disabilities Act, yes, that's what everybody thinks. But it's not so simple. As a matter of fact, that's why we have lawsuits, because the burden of proof is on on us, really. There is no no compliance mechanism that was written into the Americans with Disabilities Act. So unless we force business and government to provide the accessibility, it doesn't just happen. They don't just do it because it's the law. And with the our subway system, there was a settlement that was made over 20 years ago that every time a station would be modified, altered, renovated, they had to make it accessible. And they're not even doing that. So that's why we're suing. We're suing because we want all the stations to be accessible, because we want them made accessible when they're renovated. We want the elevators to be maintained. So we have a couple of three or four lawsuits going on, plus demonstrations.
So that explains why when you do an online search for the Disabilities Act, you find dozens of claims filed about disability discrimination across the country.
That's it, yes. And then we are criticized that there are all these lawsuits. We certainly would rather not file lawsuits, but unfortunately, you know, we're forced to. It seems to be the only way. Lawsuits and demonstrations.
So what protections are in place for people with disabilities? What has changed since this act passed in 1990?
Well, a lot has changed. Yeah. Really a lot has changed. But only because we have fought to make those changes happen in places where there is no active disability community. You find very little in terms of access, basic access, and not just for wheelchair users, but all types of access for all people with all different types of disabilities. So, yes, it's not, some people think, well, you have the ADA, so now there's no problem. What are you complaining about? But that's the reality.
So is it safe to assume that maybe in small towns, rural areas, there's not a strong movement there?
Absolutely.
And so it's even harder.
It is even harder.
For people with disabilities,
yes,
to do basic things that most people take for granted.
Yes. Yes, it is. It is. I mean, even in cities.
Right. I mean, if you're having a hard time getting around in San Francisco.
In San Francisco, I did not expect that. I really, you know, I called right away a cab, and I had no trouble getting a cab the first day on Monday. It was my first day here. So I thought, great, I will take a cab to Berkeley. This way, it'll cost me a lot, I'm sure, but I'll at least, you know, I'll go in style in a cab. But it was a mistake.
Well, and we talked last night about coming in today.
And I was still so upset.
You were so upset and so worried that you weren't going to be here. And you said, you know, I might take the bus. And I said, no, you can't do that because the bus stops way up the hill. And the hill is so steep to get to the station.
Yeah.
So there's all these different factors. And if you don't know the area, how would you know that?
Right. I guess that's why most disabled people live in the Bay Area rather than in San Francisco, in the city.
You mean in different cities around
yes,
San Francisco?
Yes, in Berkeley, in Oakland, in the East Bay area. I think Berkeley for years was the Mecca of disability rights, and many disabled people from New York City moved to Berkeley, including Judy Heumann. We see Judy Heumann as the spark that started the movement on the East Coast in New York. Judy, as a young woman, she graduated from college and wanted to be a teacher. She was a wheelchair user because of polio and was denied a license to teach. And now anyone else, the rest of us would have gone home and cried our eyes out and said, poor me, you know, I'm disabled and I can't teach. Would have accepted the common opinion that, yes, if you're disabled, what do you expect? Judy turned around and sued the Board of Education, and that really started. Then she started Disabled in Action. And I was there from the start, so I remember those days. I'm old enough. And I've seen the movement grow and change. And in the book, I tried to show how I grow and change. I develop my development is parallel with that of the movement. So at first we're just fighting for access to be part, we still are, of course, that never ends, to be part of the mainstream. And then we develop a common identity, and then comes disability pride. You can see that involvement in the book. Mm-hmm. But it's all done through the story of my life. I tried to make it as an interesting story. It is. I mean, I had an interesting life. Mm-hmm. So that people would just read it as a story and learn as they read without feeling that they were being preached to. I was afraid to do that because I am a teacher. That was my profession. Mm-hmm. I taught Italian language and literature for many years, and then I went on to teach disability studies at the New School in New York City.
So since you mentioned disability pride, you write about this in your book, really embracing this term. What does that mean to you, disability pride?
I've always defined it in the book even as the pride of the oppressed. I spoke at the Disability Pride Parade in New York City this year, and actually it was the same day we had the launch at Barnes and Noble for the book. Yes, I see it as not the pride of flag-waving Americans, but the pride of all of us who have been made to feel that we really should be ashamed of who we are. We've been made to feel that our lives don't matter as much as other people's lives, that we are not really welcome or wanted in this society. I mean, for me, whenever I cannot get into a place, it means that I'm not wanted there. And the fact that we've had to fight so hard. I very much identify. I am an immigrant because I came from Sicily. My family, you know, were working class, so this is what the pride. I see some disabled people who maybe have not experienced this much oppression. Mm-hmm. That's what I would call it. Because they have plenty of money and I don't know, so they don't really understand what's there to be proud in being disabled. But that's not what we mean. It's not that, I mean, the fact that I got polio when I did, I was 16 months old, was purely by chance. I had nothing to do with that. I am also proud of the of what we have been able to accomplish as a community, not as an individual. I don't like to hear that because, and that's usually the way it's presented. This, here's, this, the, person who had all the odds against him or her, or they, and they managed to accomplish so much. They got a degree in law. They did some this or that. And that's not what I think of when I think of disability pride at all. In fact, when we hear those kind of stories, that makes those of us who are not able to accomplish so much feel bad. While what we have accomplished as a community, as a movement, because we have organized and fought back against the prejudice, the oppression, what we call ableism, that we can be proud of. That's something I am proud of. So I don't know if that explains disability pride.
Yes, no, definitely. Let's talk about what you had to deal with as a child. You grew up in Riposto, Sicily in the 1950s. And as you write in your memoir, you heard neighbors saying, is it Che Peccato?
Che Peccato.
Che Peccato. Oh, it's so pretty.
I can read a little bit.
Yes, please.
I can read a little bit.
And that means such a shame.
It means what a shame.
What a shame.
What a shame. Yes, such a shame. What a shame.
And let me just say, so this is Nadina Lespina, and she's here in the Bay Area on a book tour. She's out with a new memoir called Such a Pretty Girl, A Story of Struggle, Empowerment, and Disability Pride. And it would be great if you would read
just a little bit right at the beginning. When I was 4 or 5, I wanted to be ugly. And got very angry when people said I was pretty. I'm ugly, brutta. Say that I'm ugly. But no one listened to me. Che bella bambina. What a pretty little girl, they all said. And inevitably, they added, che peccato. What a shame. There was such sorrow in their voices, such an anguished look on their faces. I didn't want my being pretty to make people sad. Better to be ugly, I thought. I especially didn't want my being pretty to make my mother sad. As soon as she heard those words, even if she had been laughing a minute before, my mother's eyes filled with tears and her face turned into a mask of agony. At those times, my mother looked just like the addolorata. The addolorata, the sorrowful woman, was the name of a statue in the church across the street from where we lived in the little town of Riposto, Sicily. It was a statue of Mary holding the dead Christ, a Sicilian version of Michelangelo's Pietà, the mother dressed in gold-embroidered purple silk, grief carved deeply into her painted face, on her lap her dead son, red-stained, slender limbs, draped in lifeless abandonment. People seemed as mournful when they looked at my mother holding me as they were when looking at the addolorata holding her dead son. Sometimes I thought my mother and the addolorata were one and the same. They even had the same name, Maria. Mm. I remember that very vividly, this oppressive religious atmosphere. Mm. And I went to school at, there was a convent across the street, and my mother would carry me. I was carried there all the time until I got too heavy. didn't have a wheelchair. When I was in Sicily, I'm not sure whether wheelchairs were just not available for little children, I felt that I was different from everyone else. I felt that I was not as good as everyone else. I didn't know what future, if any, I had. In Sicily, at the time, a girl's destiny, they called it, was to get married and have children. And the message that I got was that that was not for me because, of course, no man would ever want, you know, a disabled wife. And at the same time, because the fact that I was pretty kind of, you know, like they said, well, if you're ugly, you can be always be a nun or you'll end up being an old maid. I didn't think that was so bad. But that even that seemed like was not for me. And then my father, he worked. He did construction. He built houses. His dream was to take me to the United States. We're going to go to America. America, America. That's, I heard that every day. And in America, what is she? In America, you're going to be cured. And you will walk. And I kept hearing that. And again, that has, I felt that my father wanted me to be fixed somehow, that reinforced this feeling of not being good enough as I was. Something was terribly wrong with me. That's what I understood. And that unless I could be fixed somehow, I would not have any future, and my life would be no good. And I also felt that I was not the daughter that my parents wanted. Of course, my father loved me very, very much, and my mother loved me very, very much. And they were wonderful people, and they wanted to do what was best for me. And they made many sacrifices for me. And I understood that, but at the same time, there was always this feeling that I disappointed them by not being, the daughter, that they wanted me to be. And I remember my mother talking with the women in the village, the little town, about how she had given birth to a very healthy child. The baby was, when I was born, I was a big baby. I was very healthy. And it was only because of polio that I became disabled. And it was as if she wanted to blame, to push that blame away from her, like the whole purpose of being a woman, being a wife, a mother. She felt she was a failure by having a disabled child. And somehow, I mean, I didn't quite understand it that way, but I sensed all of this. So growing up in this little town, those are the memories that I retained. And they're painful memories even today. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you get kind of pulled back into the past, especially when you're writing. Mm-hmm. You're kind of reliving. Mm-hmm. And I see Riposto, by the way, as in the book. I try to, I don't know if it comes across that way, as the bad place that any of us who is disabled can find ourselves in. A place, you know, that place, that time in your life when you don't quite understand and you feel so isolated. You feel like you're the only one. I felt like I was the only one because I couldn't move around there. I was carried. I didn't know any other disabled children. I didn't know any disabled grown-ups because they were all inside their homes. They couldn't get out. And you feel that you're no good the way you are. You don't know what the future is going to bring. It's a terrible place to find yourself in. And even when you become disabled later in life, I was disabled I was 16 months old when I contracted polio. So I do not remember ever not being disabled. But even those who are disabled later in life, my husband, for example, who had multiple sclerosis, you can get stuck there in that bad place or state of mind, whatever you want to call it, where you think that your life really is over and what's going to have no future to look ahead to. Riposto becomes that in the book. And every time I mention Riposto, it's because something bad is happening in my life. And in the book, there are some bad experiences I go through. I don't want to give it all away.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Nadina Laspina, a prominent activist in the disability rights movement. She's been arrested countless times for civil disobedience, and she is out with a new memoir called Such a Pretty Girl, a story of struggle, empowerment, and disability pride. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Today's Your Call is pre-recorded. Our guests are not live here in the studio. We're not taking calls this morning. However, we always welcome your feedback. Our email is yourcall@kalw.org. Our website is yourcallradio.org. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. Tomorrow on Your Call, Rose will be talking about Uncuffed, a project started here at KALW, KALW News, that teaches people on the inside how to interview, edit, and produce news for radio and audio. That's Uncuffed on Your Call tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Trump says Iran appears to be standing down. What does that mean? That's the question this morning on 1A at 11 o'clock this morning, right after Your Call, 1/2 hour from now, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are joined by Nadina Laspina, a prominent activist in the disability rights movement. When Nadina was just 16 months old, she contracted polio. She grew up in Sicily in the 1950s with little access to medical care, and her parents decided to immigrate to the United States so she could receive better care. And we'll talk with her about that in a couple of minutes. Nadina is out with a powerful new memoir called Such a Pretty Girl, a story of struggle, empowerment, and disability pride. And Nadina, before the break, we were talking about your time growing up in Sicily, and you briefly mentioned what it was like for you to relive that. But what was it like? Because you write so much about your childhood, to revisit that time and really share it with the world.
I wasn't sure I wanted to share it with the world when I started writing. I guess I felt the need. I found myself writing, and there was so much else to do. I mean, I had to teach, so I could pay my bills, and I was an activist already and getting myself arrested, there seemed to be things that were so urgent. People who needed my help getting out of an institution, for example, finding housing, finding services. So it almost felt like self-indulgence. But I guess I needed to. And I found myself writing. And I would take whenever I had the time, I would just start writing. And it was painful. I mean, I was at times just what's interesting is I always had trouble writing at home. So I always went out to write. In the summer, I would go by the Hudson River in New York City. I live near the piers, the Hudson River. Or I would go to a cafe. And at times, I would just be crying while I was writing. And then I would notice that people were looking at me. So it was cathartic, I guess, in a sense. Mm-hmm. It was not, some parts especially were painful for me to relive. But I had this need to do it. I guess we all have a need to tell our stories. Mm-hmm. We all have stories that need to be told, and we all have the need to tell our stories. Most of us never put it into a book. Somehow I managed then to find, at the end, when I decided, okay, this is going to be a book, I had written much too much. So my biggest problem was cutting, and putting it all together.
Well, and you just said that you get so many requests from people who say, can you help with jobs or housing? And I'm guessing after this book comes out, those requests are going to increase.
If anything, yes.
Right, because I'm sure you're speaking to people who are have the same experiences today.
I get emails constantly and phone calls, yes.
Oh.
Yes. My husband and I, and I'd like to talk a little bit about my husband. He passed away recently. We would get calls in the middle of the night from someone in a nursing home, for example, like, get me out of here. I can't take it. Get me out of here. And we did all we could we would work with the Independent Living Center, and we had the organization Disabled in Action, and the organization ADAPT. Mm-hmm. We did our best to help. And at times people are trying to find housing, so I'll put them in touch and, you know, do with what lists should they get their name on, or if they're really out on the street. Sometimes there is an accessible shelter, because some of our shelters are not wheelchair accessible. So we did a lot of that work too. And that's in addition to organizing and organizing demonstrations and different events. And as a matter of fact, I wanted to talk a little bit about when I found the movement, mm-hmm. and the change that occurred in me. Because at the time I was, before I get to tell you about my husband, at the time, I was in a very bad state. I don't know. I mean, I think I have already mentioned this in other interviews. But my best friend, a young girl. She was a young girl. Then we became young women. I met her in the hospital, And still here, the messages were the same. Even though I was in this new country, we kept hearing such pretty girls. What a shame! And she was even more susceptible, more vulnerable than I was, and really believed that she would never have a happy life. And ended up very sadly committing suicide. And that threw me into a terrible, terrible depression. So finding the movement, I always see it as saving my life. Mm-hmm. I it was as if someone threw me a lifeline. I started going to meetings. Realizing for the first time in my life that, hey, it's not my fault that I'm disabled, you know? And it's not all my problem that I'm disabled. And my disability, polio, okay, that's what it is. And I've accepted it. Really, I'm doing my best to live with it. I'm used to it. This is normal for me now, really. It's the way people treat me because of it. It's the lack of services and supports. It's the lack of opportunity, equal opportunities. Those are the things that are really making life difficult for me. And those are things that can be changed. Mm-hmm. While the disability, they're never going to cure me. Those other things, we can fight together if we organize, and we can change. We can make change happen. And the first time that you start, I started seeing, something simple like a ramp being built that felt so good that, wow, we can do this. Then, of course, it wouldn't go so well. And then I would I would feel bad. Say, oh, no, forget it. This is never going to. This is a big world. It's not going to change so easily. But it made a big difference. It was also a coming home experience. The first coming home experience, by the way, what I mean by a coming home experience is meeting other disabled people and realizing that the way I feel, it's not just me, you know. There's a pattern there. We're all experiencing the same kind of discrimination. That's the word, you know. That was amazing. But the first coming home was actually in the hospital, just being with other disabled kids and comparing notes even then, you know, people staring at us, people saying such a shame, pitying us. Pity is it's so dehumanizing. It makes the person who's pitying, feel good, you know, that they're not like us. So that was the message of the telethon, you know. I remember the telethons. We fought against the telethons. That was exactly the message of the telethons. Send money so that you can to thank God that your children are not like these poor children.
Was that the message?
Yeah, it was pretty much the message. That's why people send money.
I remember those telethons, but I don't remember what they said.
Well, maybe not in exactly those words,
right,
sometimes in exactly those words.
Wow.
Yes. Look at these poor children. Aren't you happy that your children are not like these children? So, and people send money. Imagine how we felt. And we demonstrated against the telethons. Disabled in Action actually started demonstrating in the 70s, I believe, against the cerebral palsy one. That was the one where they paraded the children singing, look at us, we're walking, look at us, we're talking. It was really horrible. And then we demonstrated against the Jerry Lewis telethon. We were being made into objects of pity. And here we were fighting so hard. Who's going to hire you if they think that you're pitiful and you're probably going to die unless they find a cure? Because that's how they put it. And the cure is just around the corner. It's still around the corner, uh-huh. You know. I felt an obligation to my father, especially, who wanted me to be cured. I felt at times that I had disappointed him, because even when I was, I knew I could reason, and I knew that these feelings were just irrational. Still, they were there, it took a while. And I mean, I till the end, if you read the book, until my father dies, I just still have this feeling that he did so much for me to be cured, and it didn't happen. And I get so angry when I hear so much talk about cure, as if that's the answer, that's the only answer. And some people who become disabled later in life, especially some spinal cord injured people, there's that idea that the cure is going to come soon and all I have to do is wait. And you're putting your life on hold. Mm. And life is so precious and so short. And you need to live it now. And we need all the services, the supports. We need all the opportunities. We need everything now. Those accessible cabs, we need them now. We can't. We're not going to get cured. So at a certain point, I got over those feelings, I guess, and I understood. I mean, I always knew how much my father loved me. But I did go on record at one time. I think it was the late 90s. I said that to the New York Times, that if there was a magic pill, I would not take it. Mm-hmm. Because I was happy to be just the woman I was, a disabled woman. And you know, not everybody liked to hear that. I got a lot of negative feedback from people saying, no, we need the cure. And I never meant to say that, of course, I want there to be research done. And if any cures can be found, let us find those cures, but do not make it as the only answer, and make those of us you know, who cannot be cured feel that we're no good the way we are. Yeah. That's very that's the most negative thing.
Today we are speaking with Nadina Laspina. She is out with a new memoir called Such a Pretty Girl, a story of struggle, empowerment, and disability pride. When Nadina was just 16 months old, she contracted polio. At that time, she was in Sicily in the 1950s with little access to medical care. Her parents feared she would not get better, and they were hoping that she could receive some kind of care if they immigrated to the United States. Nadina is a prominent activist in the disability rights movement. She's been arrested many, many times for civil disobedience, even though she has asked the police, please do not arrest me. And she ends up getting arrested. I've heard you in some conversations say that when you go to these events, these rallies and actions, you talk to the police like, it's just, what's the point? Don't arrest me. And they do. I mean, and what's amazing is we've done a lot of shows about ADAPT. And I just remember these photos of so many people in their wheelchairs in Washington, D.C., going to shut down Health and Human Services to say, we demand health care and we demand to live independently. And so many of them got arrested.
I got arrested. The last ADAPT action, I was there and I got arrested. It's sometimes the police don't really want to arrest us, and they have to do their job. So, you know, I'd say, well, you do your job and I do mine. I'm known as the one who's always getting arrested. It's not like I enjoy it. Sometimes you're held in custody for hours and hours and hours while they try, because there may be 100 of us getting arrested at the same time, you know. So the police have to process each one. And sometimes, you know, they have to take your picture and fingerprint you. And sometimes there are some of us who are impossible to for the police to fingerprint. So they get all confused what to do with someone whose fist is so tight that they cannot open the hand to get fingerprints, or someone who has no arms or hands. There are people at ADAPT that are quite significantly disabled. Yet we're all there, you know, doing it. And yes, I was arrested in Mitch McConnell's office. And that was not long ago at all. Was it? September, October? And I still haven't heard what happened with that arrest. Usually the lawyers go to court for us, since there are people that come from all over the country to ADAPT actions. It's beautiful. I mean, it's it feels like family to me. And that's the good part about being put through the ordeal of an arrest, that we're together, and a bond develops. And it's always, oh yes, we've been arrested together so many times, as many times as we've been arrested. Of course, I've also been arrested for other causes, not just for disability rights. I was arrested in front of the ICE headquarters in New York City, blocking the West End Highway. I felt very strongly seeing children in cages and immigrants like me who want to come to have a better life in this country. I felt that the one thing that I could do was to get arrested. I mean, it's not like it's not like I think that it's going to make a big change. But it's in a way an act of frustration, because you don't know what else to do. I mean, yes, okay, well, we're doing everything we can. We demonstrate and we write letters and sign petitions and talk to our elected officials. And then you get to the point where it's you're so frustrated, and somehow being arrested makes you feel better. Like, at least you're doing something, mm-hmm. even if nothing is going to come of it. At least you did your part. I have been arrested for different causes, including climate change. We experienced extreme weather in New York City, and we saw how terrible it was for disabled people, especially disabled people who rely on ventilators. My husband did towards the last years of his life. And here there have been the fires and the power shutdowns, and that makes, you know, life very difficult for disabled people, and it could also be life-threatening mm-hmm. for some.
Nadina, we're almost out of time, but I just want to ask you, I'm sorry to hear about your husband. Is there anything you'd like to share with us about him?
We met in the movement. We were mm-hmm. a real movement couple. We met at the Empire State Building. Disabled in Action filed the first lawsuit in the country against the public accommodation, and we chose the Empire State Building because we thought that would attract the media attention, and it did. And that was his first demonstration. He had been diagnosed with primary progressive multiple sclerosis. His wife had divorced him, and he was going through a very difficult time in his life. And he heard about this movement, and he heard about the demonstration, and he came. And it was love at first sight for the two of us. And then we went on to organize this big event, and we fell more and more in love with each other. We were together for 27 years.
Wow.
And we did a lot of work. I think we did a lot of good work together. We worked very well together. And I fought till the end for him to be at home with me. And his biggest fear was to end up in a nursing home. But he passed away peacefully at home.
Mm.
Just months ago, this year.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
I've heard from so many people that that's what they want, is to be home and live independently.
When we started fighting, we started in 1990 with ADAPT, the fighting to free our people from institutions.
Right.
And we were thinking mostly about young people who got stuck in nursing homes and sometimes were there for their whole life. We called it serving a life sentence for the crime of having a disability. But nobody really wants to be in a nursing home. Why should an older person, and now that I'm a senior citizen myself, why should you go and end your life in a nursing home? You should stay with your family. And now it has turned around. It's taken a long time, but it has turned around, and we keep hearing about aging at home, and staying in your own home and receiving the services that you need.
Yes, and this is going to get so much attention as 10,000 people turn 65 every day in this country.
That's it.
And so many of those people have disabilities, and they might be disabilities that you cannot see.
Of course,
right?
With age comes disability.
Right.
So if we live long enough, we'll all experience disability, you know?
Well, I'm so glad you made it here, and it's been so nice to meet you. I would love to have you back to talk again, and maybe we can have a roundtable panel about how ableism exists in society and just other ways that people might not think about it.
Ableism is really part of the fabric of our society. So people do not recognize it as such. And it's also part of our socioeconomic system. The very fact that in order to receive services, you have to prove that you're poor, because you can only get those services through Medicaid or Medi-Cal here.
Right. Well, we will definitely have you back in the new year, or in a couple of months, to talk about that.
I would love to. I'll come back anytime. I don't know.
Thank you. Nadina Laspina is a prominent activist in the disability rights movement who has been arrested a number of times for civil disobedience. And she is out with a really important new memoir called Such a Pretty Girl, A Story of Struggle, Empowerment, and Disability Pride. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And you can find more information about Nadina and her work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.